you got to have a system where you're either getting more at the low end or more at the high end. And right now we've got neither.
Elected officials consider the impact of low oil prices under the state's new oil tax structure. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, January 8th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Senator Murkowski holds her first hearing as chair of the Senate Energy Committee.
I'm pretty passionate about Alaska. I'm very passionate about my state, but Alaska will not be my only priority.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you're not covered by health insurance, you may be eligible for financial help with monthly premiums and out-of-pocket expenses. Open enrollment ends on February 15th. Sign up at healthcare.gov. Last year, 88% of Alaskans who enrolled received financial assistance. Compare plans and see if you qualify for financial assistance. Call 211 to get free local help. Visit getcoveredalaska.org for more information. This message sponsored by Ashna, a partner of Get Covered Alaska.
Since the Frank Murkowski administration, every Alaska governor has offered his or her own version of oil tax reform. Now Governor Bill Walker is expressing concern with aspects of the current tax regime. He took to the pages of the Alaska Dispatch News today to say the state is currently collecting less oil tax money than it's paying out. With the free fall in oil prices, Walker wrote that the state is expecting to collect $524 million in revenue this fiscal year. Meanwhile, oil companies are eligible for $750 million in credits. He called the situation irresponsible and unsustainable and said the revenue problem must be addressed from all angles. But in an interview with APRN, Walker said that doesn't mean legislators should prepare for an oil tax fight this session.
Oh, no. No, I think that we have to look, you know, sort of across the board and give some thought. You know, nothing may be this year, and I'm not looking at going in and making any you know, significant changes. But it's just a kind of, I feel part of my job is making sure, you know, Alaskans know what I know. And this is unusual.
Last year, the state collected $2.6 billion in production taxes alone. The state still expects to collect $2 billion in royalties, corporate income taxes, and property taxes from oil production. Senator Bill Willikowski, a Democrat from Anchorage, has been a vocal critic of the state's new oil tax structure. He says the law provides larger tax credits to oil companies as the price of oil declines.
It's sort of this reverse system that was put in place, this really unusual system that they put into place where at a time when the state needs the money more, we actually give out larger credits to the oil industry. And that, in my opinion, is a flaw within the system. The other flaw is we're actually at a point where we're going to be paying out more in production tax credits than we're taking in revenue, very likely. We will be, aside from our royalties and corporate income taxes, which we get some money for, we're essentially paying the oil companies to take our oil through production tax credits, which is simply unsustainable.
Senator Willikowski, would the state be doing any better at oil prices this low under the previous tax structure, ACES?
No, we wouldn't. In fact, we would probably be paying out a little bit more under ACES. Here's the difference. Under ACES, we didn't do as well on low prices, but we made much, much more on the high end. And so you recognize over the course of time, oil prices are low, oil prices are high, you will eventually balance that out. And you've got to have a system to be durable that takes into account the highs and lows of oil prices. And so what we did with ACES was we gave up the low end in exchange for more at the high end. And so now we're in a situation where we're essentially paying the oil companies to take our oil. When the price of oil goes back up in a few years, which it's very likely to do, we won't be able to get any more revenue back through this system to make up for the tremendous bleeding of revenue that we're having right now.
Do you think, given those circumstances, that there will be momentum in the legislature for revising SB 21?
You know, I think one of the things that we didn't give a fair enough look at was the impact of SB 21 at very low prices. And all you need to do is look at the projections from the last revenue forecast, which shows massive deficits for years to come. So something needs to change, and the people of Alaska need to have a good debate about whether or not they want an income tax, a sales tax, or whether or not we want to get our fair share for our resources.
Senator Bill Wilikowski is a Democrat from Anchorage. Senator Kathy Geisel is a Republican from Anchorage, and she helped craft the new oil tax law. She says the tax structure is designed to bring in more revenue at lower oil prices than the previous law, ACES.
This year, we would have been facing $1 billion, $1 billion with a B, dollars, in tax credit liability under the former tax structure called ACES. And we knew that. So we have significantly reduced that burden, that credit burden, by reducing the number of credits in the new tax structure and actually increasing the percent tax at lower production, at lower per barrel price. So do we need to set the base tax, the minimum tax, a little higher? I don't know. Maybe. On the other hand, what we're experiencing right now is a normal valley and in prices. I expect, like everyone is opining, that yes, we're setting a new normal. It's going to be lower. But I do think that the price is going to rise again above $50 a barrel and probably settle around 80.
Do you think that proponents of SB 21 adequately considered, thought about the possibility of low oil prices or prices dropping as low as they have when this law was being written?
And I was one of those people, and yes, we did. That's why we actually raised the tax as the price per barrel went down. If you go back and take a look at those committee hearings, you'll see that exact discussion taking place. Did we know about the credits and the debt that we would owe? Yes, we did. And we compared what we were creating in Senate Bill 21 to what was in ACES. And ACES, as I said earlier, we were looking at $1 billion in liability there.
Kathy Geisel is a Republican senator from Anchorage. Senator-elect Bill Stoltz plans to introduce a bill to move the Alaska legislature to Anchorage. The Chugiak Republican isn't proposing a full-on capital move. Instead, KTUU reports that the bulk of state government would remain in Juneau and legislative sessions would be held at the new Anchorage Legislative Information Office.
I think it's a crock.
That's Senator Dennis Egan, a Juneau Democrat.
I'm really dismayed that he's pitting one section of Alaska against another.
Through a spokeswoman, Governor Bill Walker says he typically doesn't comment on how he'll deal with legislation before receiving it, but he added he doesn't favor moving the capital. This is the second time Stoltz has advocated for such a move. In 2008, he supported a similar bill introduced by Representative Mark Newman, a Republican from Big Lake. Egan says he hasn't spoken with Stoltz yet. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a renaissance for Juneau's gay, lesbian, and transgender alliance group.
We know that there are hundreds of people out there who, just even locally, want to get together and do things and build community in all sorts of ways.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com.
Senator Lisa Murkowski held her first hearing today as chairwoman of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee. The committee promptly passed the first priority of the Republican leadership, a bill approving the Keystone XL pipeline from Alberta, Canada through Nebraska. Murkowski also outlined what she wants the committee to accomplish. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
If you want to see what her priorities are as chairwoman, Murkowski, in her first statement to the committee, pointed to a 2013 document she produced called Energy 2020.
You got 115 pages, but I'll distill it to one bumper sticker for you, and that is energy is good. Energy is good. It's vital to our prosperity. It's a strategic asset that we can use to assist our allies. I believe that it is in our interest to continue making our energy abundant, affordable, clean, diverse, and secure.
Murkowski says she'll continue to emphasize the importance of the Arctic and to remind senators that the U.S., because of Alaska, is an Arctic nation. But she made it clear that, as chair, her focus will go beyond home state issues.
I'm pretty passionate about Alaska. I'm very passionate about my state. But Alaska will not be my only priority.
She gave a shout out to nuclear waste policy, electric grid innovation, and offshore development. She announced plans for a national energy bill focused on supply, infrastructure, efficiency, and accountability. She told committee members she'll talk to each of them to hear their priorities. And she reached across the aisle.
I'm optimistic. We're going to find common ground. We're going to find that common ground as a starting point.
Then, as Republican leaders have been promising for weeks, she took up the Keystone bill. With that, the kumbaya spirit left the building. Republicans on the committee described the pipeline as common sense, part of a network to move oil efficiently across North America. Democrats, though, have their line in the tar sands on this. They say Keystone aggravates fossil fuel dependence and global warming. Independent Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont says they'll have to answer to their grandchildren for their stance.
They're going to be asking us, what were you guys thinking about? What were you doing? Did you not hear what the scientific community all over the world was saying? That climate change is, in fact, the most serious environmental crisis facing this planet.
Massachusetts Democrat Elizabeth Warren, brand new to the committee, took an anti-corporate angle.
Who does this new Republican Congress work for? Foreign oil companies or the American people? Today, their first priority is to advance a pipeline that means a whole lot to an army of well-paid lobbyists and a whole lot to a giant foreign oil company.
Only Democratic Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia crossed party lines to vote for the bill, which passed 13-9.
And let me make no mistake about it. This line is already 40% constructed. The line will be built. This line will be built sooner or later. We're just delaying the inevitable.
The debate moves now to the Senate floor. Bruce Oppenheimer, a professor at Vanderbilt University, has researched congressional process and the making of energy policy. He says Murkowski, as chair of the committee, gets to set her own agenda. In part, he says that's because senators serve on so many committees, they don't have time to interfere with what a chairman wants. Oppenheimer doesn't read too much into the fact that her first bill is from the Republican leadership's to-do list.
Any chair of the Senate Energy Committee at this point who was a Republican would be having hearings on XL Pipeline to try and show that Republicans are going to get things done now that they're the majority party. But I don't think this necessarily foreshadows that she won't have independence or a good deal of autonomy as chair of that committee.
Not that she'd be successful in something like opening the Arctic Refuge to oil drilling, Oppenheimer says. He says political conditions aren't ripe for that. When it comes to winning home state prizes, the professor says that's easier to achieve with the public land matters under the committee's jurisdiction. Among those, Murkowski says she wants to work on reforming forest management, boosting national timber harvests, and improving wildfire policy. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The University of Alaska Fairbanks will field a wildfire fighting crew. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the tram will be staffed by students in a wildland fire science program.
University of Alaska Fairbanks Assistant Professor of Wildland Fire Science, Tylan Martin, is leading the effort to get students working on actual fires during the summer.
Put all of the things they've been learning in classes they've been taking to use in the field that will make them a lot more attractive to employers to receive a job in the industry.
Martin says field work has been a real hole in the program he spent the last few years building up. UAF Wildland Fire Program courses are accessible by distance delivery to rural students. Martin hopes will come to Fairbanks for the summer to be part of the fire crew.
Anybody in any rural community can apply for this crew, and we are going to put an emphasis to try to get students from those rural communities on this crew.
Martin says he's been coordinating with the Tanana Chiefs Conference and smaller village organizations on the fire crew project. He says the 20-member team will work for the State Division of Forestry and be deployed to wildfire incidents on a regular rotation.
This UAF crew will be put on a shorter list with the Type 1 crews and the Type 2 IA crews, the more specialized crews.
Martin says crew members will be able to get more experience and make more money than they would as emergency firefighters. UAF will begin taking applications next month from students interested in being on the fire crew. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Petersburg School Board will be searching for a new superintendent again this year. The superintendent of the school district has resigned after 6 months on the job. KFSK's Angela Denning reports.
Lisa Stroh was hired as superintendent July 1st after visiting Petersburg as a finalist for the position. She worked through the fall, but left town just before the Christmas break after asking the school board for administrative leave. The leave request was for December 16th to January 5th, and the board granted it. Then on December 31st, Stroh sent the board a letter of resignation stating she wanted to resign for family medical reasons. School Board President Jean Ellis reads from Stroh's letter.
I would like to thank the many wonderful people of Petersburg for making my time here so enjoyable.
Stroh stated that she wanted the resignation effective June 30th. However, the school board is proposing ending her contract now. Again, Jean Ellis.
Her contract runs through June 30th, 2015, but she will not be serving as superintendent effective immediately.
Ellis says the board will consider a proposed settlement and release agreement at a special meeting Thursday night. She wanted to wait until the meeting to release more details about Stroh's contract. How the district's budget might be affected will also be detailed at the meeting. Stroh's salary was $122,750. Ellis says all in all, the school district is in good position for a transition into new leadership.
We have an amazing school district. It's very strong and good, and I'm thinking things will move very smoothly.
Part of that transition includes longtime grade school principal Erica Klute Painter. She's been filling in as superintendent during Stroh's administrative leave, and with board approval, she would continue in that role through the end of the school year. Klute Painter agreed that the transition should be smooth, even though it's taking place within the school year.
For a mid-year transition, the change is hard, and it's a lot for people to think about, especially the immediate effects, more specifically in this building, in the elementary building, just because this is where the most change is actually happening. So I guess I want to assure people that we're going into it with a positive attitude, and it's going to be great. We're going to do this well.
Ellis says the search process for a new superintendent would begin immediately with the plan of hiring someone permanently July 1st. In Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the 2015 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Teacher nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com. If subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing are important to you, please consider applying for one of 35 seats open on your federal subsistence regional advisory councils. The seats will be filled by rural Alaskans who are knowledgeable about fish and wildlife resources in their region. Apply by January 23rd, 2015. Information at 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Juno's Alliance Group for Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Transgender, and Queer People has been going through a renaissance with new board members and new energy. Now, with recent grant funding, CIGLA hopes to increase visibility and awareness in the capital city and beyond. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
CIGLA has been around since the early 1980s, providing support for the LGBTQ community in Juneau. The name used to be an acronym for Southeast Alaska Gay and Lesbian Alliance, but it's moved away from that strict definition to be more inclusive. For years, SIGLA's programming consisted of a weekly Friday night social and an annual picnic. Last year, SIGLA organized a first-ever Pride Week in Juneau with about a dozen events. James Hoagland is one of 8 volunteer board members.
We did a film festival, a hike, a kickball game, a karaoke night, a big dance, and a picnic, all sorts of different kinds of events, because we wanted to see who was out there, who our community was, and what they needed from us. And we found that they liked all of those events, and they said, we need more of this, and we need to do it even bigger.
The annual picnic last year drew about 200 people, the biggest attendance in the organization's history. It recently received a $5,000 grant from the Pride Foundation, which supports LGBTQ groups in the Northwest. It awarded funds to 56 organizations, 3 in Alaska. This is the largest grant SIGLA has ever received. The money will help expand programming.
We know that there are hundreds of people out there who, just even locally, want to get together and do things and build community in all sorts of ways.
SIGLA is meant to be an alliance group for all of Southeast Alaska, but it's historically served just Juneau. The grant will allow the nonprofit to bridge gaps and offer services to other Southeast communities. Hoagland says individuals in Ketchikan, Haines, Sitka, and Skagway have reached out to SIGLA. Josh Hemsath with Pride Foundation in Anchorage says the organization gave funding to SIGLA for this very reason. Anchorage-based Identity Inc. also received a grant to bring students from rural areas to a youth leadership summit at Birchwood Camp.
The need that we were seeing was how best to address serving individuals, whether they be youth or people who experience geographic isolation because they live in rural and remote communities.
Outside of grant funding, Hoagland hopes SIGLA can grow in other ways.
It'll be particularly interesting during the legislative session and figuring out how to plug SIGLA into the really dynamic political landscape that's going on right now in Alaska for LGBT people.
With the legalization of same-sex marriage, Hoagland says other issues are ripe for change. Representatives Kathy Munoz, a Republican, and Democrat Andy Josephson have pre-filed bills to add sexual orientation to the state's anti-discrimination laws. Hoagland says SIGLA can play a role in education. He says many Alaskans don't even realize that people can get fired from a job because of sexual orientation.
They thought that maybe we're protected under another law or something like that. And it's just not the case. And I think that most people understand that that's just not fair. And just opening up their eyes to the importance of putting that on the books in writing so that we can make sure that people don't experience a really tragic situation like losing your job just because of the person you love.
Hoagland says making a political impact will be a natural outcome of expanding membership and strengthening SIGLA. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
A University of Washington professor has found high levels of optimism among homeless Alaska Native elders living in Seattle, and he's connecting the finding to a strong desire to pass on knowledge and experiences to future generations. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
As an Aleut who grew up in Naknek, Jordan Lewis knows a little something about Alaska Native culture. Whenever he's back home, Lewis says he likes to talk to elders and soak up traditional knowledge.
They tell stories about how Naknek used to be when they were kids. It's changing so much now. And I think just the fact that they talk to you and share their experiences and pass on recipes or how they used to make things or where they used to pick berries is this idea that they are hopeful that you'll take that knowledge and use it to benefit your own life, but then pass it on again.
Lewis is an assistant professor at the University of Washington School of Social Work. His research focuses on Alaska Native communities and generativity, a concept developed by psychologist Eric Erickson. It says that as we grow older, humans tend to want to pass on their experiences and knowledge to future generations.
The first generative act most people have in their lives is having kids. That's going to secure your future. But as you grow older, there's this need to pass on your legacy, write your memoirs, storytelling for elders and passing down stories you heard to your grandkids.
Lewis has studied how generativity helps Alaska Natives age well and become role models, as well as overcome addictions. He says he became interested in the homeless because it's an underserved and often overlooked population. Years ago, he says his family had a relative involved with the Chief Seattle Club, a nonprofit that provides meals, housing assistance, and other services to low-income and homeless Alaska Natives and American Indians. That's where he and a student interviewed 14 Alaska Native elders last year. He says the results surprised even him.
All of the elders talked about the importance of giving back and teaching others, whether it's through sharing a sandwich, giving extra change if they had extra change to someone who wasn't doing as well as they were. Volunteering at the Chief Seattle Club was almost everybody's response. That's what made them happy. That's what got them up every day. And they all said that they did that because it's going to come back to them in a positive way.
He says other themes of the interviews included the importance of laughter and religion. In addition, each of the elders, ages 45 to 70, filled out surveys to measure generativity and optimism. Lewis says 12 of the 14 individuals scored very high in both.
That kind of complemented the qualitative interview. So I could say, you know, 85% of the people I interviewed are very optimistic and like to give back and teach the young people. And then here we have specific examples of what they do that.
While he's excited about the early results, Lewis admits more research is needed to confirm his findings. He'd like to do more than 100 interviews and has considered expanding to include American Indians. He's planning to present his research at the Chief Seattle Club and ask officials there for ideas on how to do a broader study of Native homelessness.
How could we either help the people who are homeless, or how do we prevent homelessness, or how do we make their lives more enjoyable from these experiences of what these elders are doing for themselves?
Lewis also hopes to publish his findings in a peer-reviewed journal. The initial study was part of an online Stanford University program on successful aging that he participated in last year. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Jeremy Shea, Jennifer Canfield, Casey Kelly, and Lisa Fu in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Angela Denning in Petersburg. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau, and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. Enroll now in the health insurance marketplace. Sign up at healthcare.gov. Open enrollment ends February 15th. Depending on your income, age, and family size, you may be eligible for discounts that may lower your monthly costs and out-of-pocket expenses. Pick a plan that is right for you and your family. Call 211 for free individual assistance about the health insurance marketplace. Visit GetCoveredAlaska.org for more information. This message sponsored by ASHNA, a partner of Get Covered Alaska.
Alaska Pacific University offers the APU Promise Tuition Grant, a program designed to significantly minimize or eliminate out-of-pocket tuition expenses for Pell-eligible students. Deadline to apply is March 1, 2015. Alaska Pacific University is a private nonprofit offering small class sizes with a student-centered approach in the arts and sciences. More at 1-800-252-7528. This message is sponsored by APU.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.